Now, the politics of postmodernism is significant, and we do have to say quite a few things about the politics of postmodernism. Here I will say a few things about Heidegger as a transition here, partly because Heidegger is a collectivistic in his social philosophy, and then in his personal political views, he was a member of the National Socialist Party. He joined, and on my reading of him, he was a very gung-ho, right, Nazi, a signatory to a document that many German professors signed, right, explicitly endorsing the nationalist socialist philosophy, its political agenda for Germany, and pledging to reshape the universities in terms of national socialist educational philosophy. And so here you have the leading philosopher in Germany, right, of his generation, explicitly signing on to national socialist philosophy, with all of its collectivisms, right, in various forms, its anti-individualism, its anti-democratic republicanism, its anti-capitalism, its anti-Semitism, right, and so forth. The explicit authoritarianism is very strongly in Heidegger. Now, I mention all of this because when you get to postmodernism, one of the striking things is going to be is that the first generation and the second generation of postmodern thinkers are all at the far left end, right, of the political spectrum. Many of them in their youth were members of the Communist Party, or if they weren't members of the Communist Party, nonetheless, they thought of themselves as Marxists. Some of them as classical Marxists, some of them as one of the many forms of neo-Marxism and so forth that were kicking around in the 20th century. And so to a large extent, they would see themselves as anti-Nazi, right, or anti-fascist. But what's going to be more important, particularly by the time we see this in our generation of postmodernism, what I think of as the third generation of postmodernism, is that the distinctions between the fascists, right, coming from the right end of the political spectrum and the communists coming from the left end of this political spectrum seem to be pretty insignificant, right? Many of the fascist tropes, right, that were used by the Nazis in the 20s and 30s and on into the 40s, we see them now again in the 90s, noughts, and into the teens, right, of the 21st century. So at a deeper level, the irrationalism, the notion that people are first and foremost members of a group, that the individual only is a concatenation, right, of group identities, that in a felt emotionalist way you just need to commit yourself to your group memberships, that there's no meaningful dialogue, right, across group membership competing groups possible, that you don't appeal to people on the basis of reason and argued discourse, instead that fundamentally we use argument as a rhetorical weapon, including all of the ad hominem and nasty tactics that traditional liberal education tells you are bad. We embrace all of those, including a willingness to shut things down by force, to physically harass people, to use explicit power plays in the classroom or wherever we can. All of those old fascist tactics, all of those taken to the street, communist tactics, that's in third generation postmodernism. So what we have then is kind of far left and far right, right, merging, right, both in theory and practice by the time we get to our generation of postmodernism. All right, I'll pause there. We can make another transition here. Sure. All right. Okay. Yeah, postmodernism as a political movement. Now, in my reading, much of postmodernism is politicized. And I do think that one of the major ways of getting to postmodernism and one of the major rationales for postmodernism, first and foremost, is politics. I don't want to say that it's the only way to get to postmodernism. I think there are ways to get through postmodernism through epistemology, through the dead ends of skepticism and relativism that some deep thinkers think come out of epistemology. I think it is possible to get to postmodernism through certain views of human nature, breaking down the idea that there is such a thing as an individual, such a thing as an autonomy, human dignity and moral responsibility, that those are all meaningless concepts, and so that some sort of deep collectivism and social determinism is true. You can get to postmodern themes or much of it right through those ways as well. But I do think much of postmodernism in all three of its generations now is explicitly motivated by political concerns, and that I don't think it's an accident that in the first two generations explicitly, all of the leading postmodern thinkers are at the far left of the political spectrum. You count down whatever you think the first tier, second tier, third tier, top 100 postmodernists, all of them are at the left end. And postmodernism is to a large extent being used as a set of rhetorical tools, right, arrayed against explicitly right political targets, right, the ones that don't square with certain political tactics. Now, we can talk about cultural Marxism, right, or neo-Marxism, and I think that is a legitimate concept, that it's a generalization on themes that are first and foremost coming out of Marxism. Michel Foucault, when he was young, joined the French Communist Party, right? Lyotard was the editor, right, of various communist and neo-communist journals. All right, I'm going to ask you to make a decision, okay, for the next 5 minutes, to either to stay here or go elsewhere. Okay? Okay, do you want to stay here or do you want to go? Okay, thanks. We're getting there. We're in the final stages. Okay. Lyotard was editor of various far-left right journals. Derrida, right, hung out in communist circles. He did not join the Communist Party, but published in various communist journals and at various points said things like, deconstruction, his literary method, had no meaning for him except in the spirit of Marxism. Right, in a certain kind of Marxism, but it's going to be an updated Marxism. Richard Rorty was not a Marxist, right, but on the American context, he's about as far left as you can get and still kind of remain in the American political spectrum right context as well. So I don't think it's accidental, and I think it's important to recognize that all of the leading postmodern thinkers are doing sophisticated epistemological work. They are saying skeptical, relativistic, and negative things about the possibility of narratives and meta-narratives, right, and so on, but at the same time, they are all signing on as young people to what they take to be an idealistic social system that's at the very far end of the left spectrum. Now, why that is the case, that's a very interesting question, right? My explanation for that is that postmodernism is coming into being in the 1950s. I think that's the important generation. 1950s is important because it's after the 1940s. The dominant event of the 1940s, of course, is World War II. But after World War II, the world is picking itself up, normalizing to a significant extent. Yes, we do have the Cold War looming over everyone's heads, right? But, right, there is a space for normal life to get going, right, once again. Prior to that, we had the Great Depression. Prior to that, we did have the 1920s, and things are not bad, right, in the 1920s, but we still are reacting to the horrors of World War I. So it's been a very grim first half of the century, and the question by the time you get to the 1950s is, well, what are the deep philosophical lessons that we're supposed to learn, right, from all of this horrible philosophical and political and economic history that's going on there? Existentialism, right, with all of its doom and gloom, right, is one direction, right, that we can go. The postmodernists are drinking from that well to some extent as well, because it's a very doom and gloom, right, movement, lots of criticism and anxiety and uncertainty. uncertainties, right, are built into the movement right there as well. The idea that so somehow the Enlightenment, with all of the promise of science and technology and capitalism, was going to make everybody better off, right, and so forth. Well, science has produced, right, all of these horrible weapons that were used in World War I and World War II. And if you're at the left end of the political spectrum, right, you look at the Great Depression and you say, oh, that's a fault of capitalism. Capitalism has come to its end. So from their perspective, all of the fruits of the Enlightenment that were supposed to bear fruit have turned rotten, and so we have to abandon the Enlightenment. Now, at the same time, by the time you get to the 1950s, there is a major problem, though, with what is supposed to be the alternative to capitalism, and that is Marxist socialism. Lots of versions of socialism in the 1800s and 1900s, but by the time you get to the 1900s, Marxist socialism is basically the game in town. Right, the success of the Russian Revolution, everybody in the world is saying, oh, Russia and the now Soviet Union is going to lead us to a brighter future. Right? And so that's why, you know, huge numbers of intellectuals are signing on to Marxism and seeing the Soviet Union, not the United States, right, as the moral beacon, right, of the future. But the problem is going to then be, by the time you get to the 1950s, we've now had the Soviet Union for 35, right, or 40 years, and there are some unsettling signs, right, that are coming out of the Soviet Union, right? And you can't just dismiss all of this as just CIA propaganda, right, at this point, as people, right, want to do. The economic performance, right, does seem to be lagging. As much as we're critical of what's going on in the West, it does seem in the West, in the freer nations, right, people are even ordinary working people have cars, right, they have television sets, they're taking vacations, people are getting fatter, right, it's not poverty, right, and so on. There are problems, but things are going pretty well. And then the honest voices looking at what's going on in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries now, things are starting to look, right, pretty grim. It's also a problem because now by the time we get to the 1950s, it's been over one century since Marx and Engels and Communist Manifesto said the revolution is coming, right? We're going to have fewer and fewer capitalists controlling all of the resources, right? Well, by the time we get to the middle part of the 20th century, we don't have fewer and fewer millionaires and so forth. Instead, we got more and more millionaires, right? People are getting richer and richer. It's not the case that the middle class is getting squeezed out by this ruthless capitalist competition, right? That some few of them are becoming very rich and lots of them are becoming poorer and poorer and being pushed into the proletariat. Instead, we've got this huger and huger and huger middle class, and they're doing pretty well, right, by and large. And then the poorest members of society, well, classical Marxism had said there's going to be more and more poor people, that the logic of capitalist exploitation is people will be, you know, driven to subsistence wages, they'll be horribly exploited, right, by the worker or by the capitalists, just barely enough to live on. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case. Instead, what it seems to be the case is if you look at the poorest segments, yes, there is poverty, right, in the United States and England and Australia and Canada, where I'm from, right, and so forth, but it's a pretty good-looking poverty, right, by historical standards, and it's better than what was going on 50 years before and better and so forth. And instead of there being more poor people, we have fewer, right, poor people. And one sign of this is that it's recognized by the left thinkers, right, who are starting to say, we can't argue anymore that capitalism causes people to become poorer and poorer. So this notion of absolute poverty, we have to give up on it, which is why in the 1950s, the notion of relative poverty, right, comes to be important. Right? Poverty is socially relative. So it's not the case that the poor people in society are starving. Right. Instead, the problem is that they see that other people have more than they do. Right. I only have, right, 1 5-year-old car, and look at that. Those guys overdrive there. They get a new car every year, and that really makes me angry. So we have class conflict, but it's a relative, right, class conflict. Right. So my kids are going to school and they're going off to university, right, and so forth. But they're not going to the elite universities. I can only afford to send my kid to the state universities, right, and so forth. Or I have only black and white TV, and now some rich people get color TV, and that's just gets me, right, and so on. So the notion of relative poverty, and you see this major shift in the left, means that they are grappling with how are we going to assess how to attack capitalism, right, given that classical Marxism's predictions about how capitalism was supposed to go didn't happen. We aren't seeing the class consciousness of the proletariat. We're not seeing a revolutionary proletariat class. Instead, they seem to be pretty complacent and so on. So the argument then is that by the 50s, what the far left's main strategists are saying is that we need a new strategy, a new way of attacking capitalism that is not classical Marxism. We need to have something maybe in the spirit of Marxism, as Derrida said, but it is going to not require us to say, here's the logical evidence that shows socialism's superiority. We don't have the logical evidence of it anymore. We don't have the historical and logical statistical evidence that shows that capitalism is mired, ensnared in contradictions and causing poverty. The statistics seem to be right against us, right, and so on. So what we then need is a new strategy. And so one argument is, if you want to retain your faith in socialism, okay, and that faith language, right, takes us back to Kierkegaard. How do I retain my faith in religion if all of the logic and evidence seems to be going against religion? Well, I attack logic and reason, right, and I re-embrace my faith. How do I retain my faith in socialism if logic and evidence aren't supporting it, and it seems like logic and evidence actually is on the side of the capitalist, damn it, right? Well, I find a way to attack logic, I find a way to attack reason, and say that proper values are rather a commitment to a way of looking at the world, or a narrative that gives you a sense of authenticity and meaning in your life. So all of the new epistemologies in the 1950s that are starting to become fairly skeptical, about percepts, about concepts, about language, about logic, about science, and so forth, and all of the leading postmodern thinkers are well-versed, right, in epistemology. At the same time, they can then say, well, maybe there is a narrative that makes free market capitalism and liberalism look pretty good, but that's just one narrative, right? There are other competing narratives. And when we have all of these competing narratives, the way we make choices is not through logic and putting things through the empirical test. We now know that that's all just subjective. Instead, it's an emotionalist commitment, right, that you have to make. And so it's perfectly fine then for me to say I'm not interested in the capitalist narrative. I don't have to look at the statistics. I don't have to do the history. I can just make a passionate commitment to my left-wing value framework and join the movement and use the postmodern rhetorical tools as a weapon against my ideological adversaries. Okay. All right. You are right. All right. You're officially justified in being cranky. And I think we're actually, maybe that would be a good point to stop. Because, actually, I'm going to say 3 more minutes. I'm going to answer question number 19. Okay. All right. All right, 3 minutes and then we're done. Okay, right. That's a commitment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. So yes, okay. By the time we get to the current generation of postmoderns, if you do the sociology right of the movement, particularly in terms of campus activists, most of them are coming out of the left end of the political spectrum. And so it is an anti-capitalist, right, anti-liberal, right, anti-free market, anti what they take to be the dominant shape of Western society, anti-Westernism of the last century, right, or two. But it is at the same time not a traditional left philosophy, right, because the epistemology is entirely different. Instead, you see explicit skepticism, explicit language of there being no meta-narratives, only subjective narratives that are in competing clash, and there's no way rationally to reconcile the differences. And an explicit notion that, therefore, the only way people of different groups can settle their disagreements is through physical coercion, right, ultimately, taking it to the streets, and that's exactly what's going on. So yes, the epistemology of socialism did change dramatically in the 1950s and the 1960s, right? And that's the break between the old left and the new left, Right? So the new left is a self-conscious label that the left is ascribing to itself in the 1960s, and part of that is to say that we can't use the same tired old epistemology of traditional socialism. So Marx, for example, was a semi-child of the Enlightenment. He did say that his version of socialism was scientific socialism. Right? And so his argument is that if you do your social science properly, all of the evidence will prove the truth that socialism is true, both morally and a historical right inevitability. And so we make certain predictions that can be verified by the historical evidence. So that then is to say that socialism is embracing a particular epistemology, the Enlightenment epistemology of logic, evidence, social science methodology, putting the theory to the empirical test, right, statistically and so forth. But the game is up by the 1950s and the early 1960s, and I think the deep thinkers on the far left have recognized that if you play that game, you're going to lose, because the evidence, the logic, and the statistics are not on the side of socialism, so you need a new epistemology. That's why they're embracing the language of skepticism, that's why they're embracing the language of logic, that's why they're saying there are no such things as true narratives, realistic understandings, right, of reality. It's all social constructions by means of various language, but language is socially mediated and constructed by various social groups, so we're all trapped in the various language games our different groups play, and they're in conflict with each other, so let's take the conflict to the streets, and that's what we get now.
All right.
It is a lot. All right. I hope you can sift through all of that to find the usable material.